Hey, babe, what do you want to do tonight?
The same thing we do every night, Pinky. Try to take over the world.
Hey, welcome back, friends, to another episode of The Amber May Show. So glad you are joining me today because I have Nick Freitas joining me, and you might know him from his YouTube channels. He's also a delegate in the Virginia State Legislature. And so he's joining me today, and we're going to be talking about culture in the United States and what has happened over the course of many decades, and how is America shaping up today? I hope you will like, share, and subscribe. We had an amazing conversation I think you're really going to like. So please like, share, and subscribe. If you believe what I'm doing, please consider becoming an angel investor. And the easiest way to do that is going to theambermayshow.com and hit the donate button. You can be a $5 monthly subscriber by going to theambermayshow.locals.com. I always add more content. Join me on Telegram at The Amber May Show. I'm on True Social Amber May, Frank Social Amber May, and Cloud Hub. Find me there. For those of you that are preppers out there, I've partnered with Prepper All Natural. Prepper offers amazing high quality cooked and freeze dried beef along with long term storage. Eat well today and tomorrow. And you can check out their food at freedomfirstbeef.com. That's freedomfirstbeef.com. And when you're there, use promo code Amber at checkout to save some money. So freedomfirstbeef.com, promo code Amber at checkout. So before we get to Nick, I wanted to share with you one other thing because the pricing is extraordinary. You're not even going to find this pricing at Walmart. So all you know out there that Mike Lindell and MyPillow no longer have the support of the big box stores or the shopping channel the way they used to. They've been a part of the big cancel culture going on, and they want to pass the savings right on to you directly. They're having a huge $25 extravaganza sale. So when Mike started MyPillow, it was just a problem solution, one product, and that was it. Well, since then, with the help of his dedicated employees, they now have hundreds of products some of you may not even know about. To get the word out there, they're having a $25 extravaganza. Two-pack multi-use MyPillow, $25. Where are you going to find that deal? MyPillow sandals, $25. This is where it gets super good. I love the towel set. The six-piece towel set, $25. You can't even get that price at Walmart for a six-piece towel set. The towels are out of this world. Brand new four-pack dish towels, and you guessed it, just $25. And for the very first time, the premium MyPillow with the all-new Giza fabric, any size, any loft level, even king size, just $25. This amazing offer won't last long, so order now. Just go to MyPillow.com. Or call 1-800-957-2123. That's 1-800-957-2123. And use promo code Amber. And when you do, you'll get free shipping on your entire order today. MyPillow.com. Use promo code Amber. Well, without any further ado, I'd love to welcome Nick to the program. Well, like I told you, friends, I have the one and only Nick Freitas joining us today. Welcome, Nick, to the program. So happy to have you.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, you know, I'm so glad I found you through my husband. And thank you for giving me the brownie points with him because he introduced me to you through videos. And he looked at me, he's like, hey, do you think you could interview him? I'm like, why not? Let me try. So, I mean, as soon as I said, yeah, Nick said, yes, the brownie points with my husband shot through the roof. So like, thank you so much for that. Appreciate
it. No, it's my honor. Thank you.
So, you know, some of the people that listen to me may not know much about you. And I think you have quite an interesting life. What I know about you is you are a state legislator, but you've also served, I believe, as a Green Beret in the military. You're a husband and a father. But so can you walk us through kind of like the path that you took? Like, how did you get from, you know, being a man, deciding you want to be in the military to now serving in the state legislature? How did that progression happen?
Sure. Well, I first met my wife in high school, And we started dating my senior year, and I went off to infantry basic training over at gorgeous Fort Benning, Georgia. and I thought for sure, I was like, there's no way this lady who's way out of my league is gonna stick with me through basic. But she wrote me every day when I was in basic training. And we got married shortly after. I went to the 82nd Airborne. And we were in the Army 11 years. We had all three of our children. We had our oldest daughter, Lily, in Hawaii when I was stationed over the 25th Infantry. And then we had our son, Luke, and our daughter, Allie, when I was with 1st Special Forces Group over at Fort Lewis, Washington. After 9/11, that's when I had decided to volunteer for Special Forces. So I did a couple of tours over in Iraq with 1st Special Forces Group on ODA 193 and later 1333. I love being in the military, but I got very, very frustrated with the difficulty of being able to conduct operations. This was in 2006 and then 2008 in Iraq, 2008-2009. And it just seemed that the bureaucracy was just reaching a level of nonsense that was truly absurd. And at some point you start asking yourself, are we even trying to win this thing? Mm-hmm. When it takes a 42-page CONOP for a Green Berets to be able to get outside the wire and actually conduct operations. And then, you know, some battle space owner gets their feelings hurt because you rolled up a big target without them knowing. And now all of a sudden you're not allowed to operate there anymore. I mean, it really was getting that petty. Mm-hmm. And I remember, married, three kids. I'd been in active duty 11 years and I really did. I loved Special Forces, but I remember Tina and I talking about it and kind of coming to the decision. I thought I was going to get out. And I had a sergeant major that I really, really admired, really respected, Sergeant Major Wynn. And he said, what are you doing getting out at 11 years? I said, well, mm-hmm. Sergeant Major, I listed all the things I had a problem with. And he said, well, that's a ridiculous answer. He goes, if you got problems, then you stay and you get the rank and you fix the problems. And I said, well, that sounds great. You're a sergeant major. How many problems you've been able to fix?
Exactly. Yep.
And he exactly. said, he had some choice words for me, but he said, that's fair. And I said, well, that's because mm-hmm. the problems that we're facing are not so much because of the guys in uniform, the problems that we're facing because of the guys in Washington, D.C.
That's exactly right.
And so, I got out of the military. I still did work within the defense sector, kind of in the counterinsurgency, counterterrorism side of it on the contracting side, and started to get more involved in politics. And I thought that, I grew up, my mother had been involved in politics, but never elected office. And I didn't really necessarily think I was going to run for elected office. I thought I was just going to maybe work on the policy side. And I had a friend ask me to run. And the first time I said no, which is probably the wisest answer. But 2 years later, I got asked to run again. And so I did. And I've been serving in the Virginia House of Delegates for the last 9 years. And about 4 years ago, we started becoming far more active on social media, in part because of what happened during COVID, and in part because now that I've been in the legislature for 9 years, I can tell you right now, when people say that politics is downstream from culture, it's absolutely accurate. And if we're not effectively engaging in the culture, then it's ridiculous to assume that we're going to get the sort of political victories that we would like. And so mm-hmm. that's kind of a once over the world on meeting my wife, getting married, having kids, serving in the military and the legislature, and then becoming more involved in social media and what I would say is the cultural front of the battle we find ourselves in right now.
Nick, you're right. Your wife is gorgeous. I was like, wow. When I first saw her on one of your videos, I was like, wow, she is absolutely beautiful. You know, men always say that, but then sometimes like the wife's like, okay, she's all right. She's covered. Like your wife's really pretty. So good for you, Nick. Good for you.
I tell people the secret is we had a graduating class of 27. She didn't know any better. And I married her before she had a chance to find out.
No, you know, it's the men in uniform thing. Probably. I mean, you know, once you put that uniform on, like that's one of my things. Like when men put that uniform on, I'm like butter, you know, like I'm like, wow, so gorgeous. You know, you did. So you're in the military, Army, counterintelligence. I know General Flynn and I know he did a lot of counterintelligence. Did you guys ever work together while you were?
Well, I worked on the counterinsurgency side. So Green Berets work a lot in unconventional warfare, counterinsurgency, counterterrorism. I was definitely in the same time General Flynn was. But as you can imagine, I was a sergeant first class. So we ran in different circles.
Yeah, I just wasn't sure about that. But yeah, for sure. You know, I agree with General Flynn when he says local action creates national impact. And I have taken that to heart ever since I met the man. And when God called me back into broadcasting, I was a radio broadcaster for many years in Phoenix. And then I quit when I had my kids. And God's like, you need to do this again. And I was like, oh, right. And so when I met General Flynn through a series of events, and he would sit with us as a bunch of podcasters in a room and say, hey, you know, local action creates national impact. I ended up going to a legislative district meeting. Do you guys, I mean, I don't know how it is in Virginia. Do you guys have those monthly meetings too, where you precinct committeemen or whatever you might call them meet up together, and then the representatives of that district show up to the meeting? Do you guys have that in Virginia?
Yeah, we have county committees. We have local county committees that will meet usually at least once a month. And then we have legislative district committees that will meet, I think monthly or sometimes quarterly. It just depends, but yeah.
Yeah, because I'm a part of the Republican Party in Maricopa County. And so we meet as a legislative district once a month and our state legislators show up. And it was about the time in, you know, 2020 and Maricopa County and the election interference. And I was so frustrated because so much was happening during that time. I was seeing my Constitution just dissolve right in front of my face. Now we no longer have the right to vote. Someone's choosing it for us. The freedom of speech issue, cancel culture was going everywhere. Churches were being canceled because of COVID, which I didn't understand, because per Constitution, the government cannot interfere in religious activities. If the churches wanted to stay open, they should have stayed open, but they closed. And unfortunately, that's the time we need God the most. People were dying around us. Fear was all over the place on TV. And yet the one place that we really should have been able to have access to is churches. So all this is going on in my personal life, and I decided I need to do something about it. So I went to a legislative district meeting, and then I had to open my mouth, right? I just had to open my mouth. And then they got me into becoming a precinct committee. And I'm like, oh, goodness. I'm like, there we go.
Oh, yeah. I used to be a unit chairman in a local county. And yeah, as soon as someone showed up and they were active and they were interested, it was like, oh, yeah, we're going to put you to work.
And, you know, I'm not a state legislator, but, you know, it got me involved to make a difference. So I try to listen to, like, God movements. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I started hearing parents in my everyday life come up to me and start sharing with me that they had to go to family court at one time in their life, like so random that it wasn't normal conversation. And it was stuff that happened in their past. And these are good parents, nothing that they did wrong. And then I started getting interviews with parents that have lost kids to CPS and things like that. Good parents that never abuse their kid, but we have the system. So I'm like, okay, God, are you trying to do something here? And so I started working on a bill with my state legislator, and I've never, ever written legislation before. I never helped in legislation. I never, ever went to the Capitol before. I never did any of those things. And last year, someone in our party killed it in appropriations, because last year we had the ability to delegate so much money to add juries to family court. Because you, sir, served in the military. You believe in our Constitution. You serve in your state legislature. And our Constitution says we have a right to be tried by a jury of our peers. And it doesn't specify that if it's only this crime or that crime or the other crime, it says we shall. And in family court in Arizona, that doesn't happen. And so parents that are facing termination, which is the scariest thing, the only thing worse than losing the rights of your kids is the death of your child. There's nothing worse than that, because imagine if you're a parent and let's say you just don't agree with a transgender ideology, you want to do things differently, but someone in the school system thinks, no, you need to transition your kid. I'm going to file CPS. It's that easy in many states across our nation to have your kid removed. So my bill simply said, we are going to have a trial by jury if parental rights are being severed. And this year it passed the House. And it's in the Senate, almost it's into the Rules Committee and about to be on the Senate floor. But there's been so much attack on just something simple as that, protecting constitutional rights, protecting the family. And one thing I admire about you, Nick, is you were very strong in your videos on family. I would love you to explain why you choose that topic in a lot of your videos that you do.
Well, I think one of the things that, again, I've noticed being involved in politics is obviously people see a lot of things that are going on in the country right now, and they're frustrated and they're angry about it, and rightfully so. And I'm glad when those people are involved in politics, but I'm absolutely convinced that our country is in the shape it's in because our families are in the shape they're in. Mm-hmm. And so when you have a situation where families are no longer strong, when you have a situation where the whole idea of fatherhood is kind of commonly mocked within the arts and entertainment world, where we have this version of fourth wave feminism that essentially denigrates moms that do want to raise their children, that do want to educate their children, as opposed to going into the workforce, as if doing all of that is not work. Mm-hmm. All of that, I think, creates this sort of scenario where now families are significantly weaker, and you have children spending a lot more time away from their parents and into institutions that are ultimately, or in many cases, you know, run by the government. And so it's really important to me at a time where I feel that traditional masculinity, what we might call traditional femininity, a lot of those things are under attack by the popular culture. Because what we're seeing more and more is the people that have bought into this narrative, that men, you know, men don't have to fill that traditional gender role of being protectors and providers. They're not happy, right? They're not happy with the result of what they've created and what they've advocated for. When you look at the number of women that are wondering, where have all the good men gone? Where have all mm-hmm. the strong men gone? Well, I'm sorry, fourth wave feminism doesn't support or encourage strong men. So you're not happy with what your ideology has produced. And more often than not, I see this competition going on for what things like genuine masculinity look like, because there's a lot of different voices right now that young men are listening to. And I think some of them are far better than others. But ultimately, I think if you're going to save the country, then it's going to start by saving the family. And that's going to start by, once again, appreciating the various roles that we play within that family unit. And more people are going to realize that they have been sold a bill of goods. And unfortunately, the way that they're going to realize that is the relationships in their life are not working for them. The decisions that they've made are not bringing them any sort of peace or joy or long-term satisfaction. And at some point, they're going to look around and say, you know what? Hollywood's lied to me. The music industry's lied to me. The experts at universities have lied to me. The sociology department at Berkeley's lied to me. I just want to see what works. And as they look around, they're going to look for the people that are in the sort of stable relationships that have the sort of family structure that they want to see. And those are the ones that they're going to start going to and asking, okay, what did you do differently? And mm-hmm. so I think creating a space where we can actually talk about these things and not lift it up as if, hey, as long as you follow these four easy steps, everything's going to be fine. That's mm-hmm. not how marriage works. That's not how mm-hmm. families work. There's always going to be difficulties. There's going to be challenges. The difference is that when you follow certain guidelines, those challenges make you stronger, not weaker.
I'm going to get to that thought in just a second, but right now I'm going to take a quick break. Hey, I'm Christina Bob, and you are listening to The Amber May Show. Hey friends, are you looking for a financial planner you can trust? Well, look no further than EPS Wealth Management. I work with a wonderful team of individuals, and my part in the team is the marketing director and one of the insurance professionals. Our investment strategy works in an up or down market. It actually works harder for you in a down market. So we have an income-based approach versus a growth-only approach. If you are interested in a strategy that's going to work harder for you, even in a down market, are you looking to own some gold and silver? Well, look no further than EPS Wealth Management, because we can lock in some great pricing for you and have it shipped right to your house hassle-free. How would you like to have a pension income for life? It's a great complement to income-based investing in the stock market, and the whole thrust is more income in retirement than you need and can easily spend so you can do the things you've always dreamed of doing and be able to help others in need and leave a legacy for your family. Income also doubles during times of health problems with where long-term care events occur, like dementia, cognitive impairment, having trouble getting in and out of bed. And even if you spend your account down to zero, your basic income will continue as long as you live. So if any of this financial planning is of interest to you, give us a call. Check us out at iloveeps.com. That's iloveeps.com, and let them know Amber sent you.
You are listening to The Amber May Show, and now we return to the show already in progress.
And it's been really sad to see that, but I'm so grateful for platforms that have been open to free speech, like Rumble, like, you know, thank God for Mike Lindell bringing Frank's speech and Donald Trump True Social. And so we've been able to have some of these free speech platforms come up so that there's still that voice out there that is talking about what you mentions, what you talk about on your video all the time. And for it's common sense stuff that you talk about, but it's almost like there's been a void in the marketplace for the basic things you talk about. I love how you talk about raising your son. I mean, I love that there's a strong male figure in your kid's life, because so many kids these days don't have that strong male figure. And it takes two parents to raise a kid. It is so hard. I mean, my husband works very long hours, and it is so hard to always be the one to take care of the kids on a regular basis, because, you know, as much as you love your child, it wears on you. You're a caretaker, you know, someone's always depending on you. And so it's so wonderful when dad comes home and can give you that relief that you need, or back you up when your kid is acting a fool, you know, have that backup. It feels so good to have that backup. And you said something so important when on that video with your son. You said, if you want your son to know what it's like to have a good wife, or something along that lines, then the way you treat his mother is the way he's going to treat his future wife, or something to that effect. Yeah, and I thought that was so well said.
No, it's critical. Your kids are watching your marriage and your relationship in order to get ideas for how their own marriage or relationship should look like. And I tell this story once where one of my kids, when they were a teenager, they're like 13, 14 years old. I was walking down the stairs, and as I turned the corner, you know, they were having a spat with my wife. And as they walked out, as they kind of stormed out of the room, they made this little, you know, face. And I remember stopping her at the time and saying, "Don't you ever speak to my wife that way again." And it shocked her a little bit, because I didn't say your mother, I said my wife. And I had somebody ask me, isn't that a little bit harsh? I said, no, because one, she needs to know that I have her mother's back no matter what. And two, she needs to expect that one day her husband will have her back no matter what.
I love that.
And it's the same thing with our sons as well. Like when the way I treat his mother is going to tell him a lot about how he should be treating women and how he should one day treat his wife. And so everything that we do right there is, or everything that we do in those moments is a, for lack of a better term, I kind of hate the term teachable moment because it gets overused so much, but it really does. It provides memories that your kids are going to look back to as they're establishing kind of the rules and the guidelines for their own relationships. And you can sit there and tell them all day long what they should do or what they shouldn't do. But the first thing they're going to look for is, do you do it? Mm-hmm. And there's definitely been times where I've fallen short of that, but that's also important too, is that when you do fall short, you don't give yourself excuses in front of your kids. You admit that you fell short. That way they know that the values that they're teaching them are actually values. They're not just convenient things that you apply when it works for you as the parent. They're actually rules that you live by as well. And when they can see you fall short of those, as you inevitably will, but then you own up to it, you live up to it, and then you also change your own course of action in order to correspond with what you've taught them. And again, it reinforces that what you're teaching them is truth, not just an arbitrary rule that you get to enforce because you happen to be the parent.
I love how you add like your mic drop moment in all your videos, because as soon as you're done with that knowledge bomb, you take that cup and you take a sip and everyone wants to know what's on that cup, because whatever is on that cup had to do with what you're talking about. Like, it's brilliant. That's brilliant. I just think it's great, because I look forward to the video, and then at the end I'm going to say, what's the cup say?
Yeah, it has become a it wasn't something we intended at first, but it has become a clever way to make sure everybody watches to the end of the video.
It's true. It's great. It's fantastic. And then one thing that you've been hitting on lately is, and something I've been bringing out, and maybe I should ask you this first before I bring out some of the recent topics you've talked about on your show. When did you start seeing the change in our government? Because clearly we have a communistic agenda that's trying to take over. And we know the Chinese Communist Party are really behind a lot of this stuff. We know a lot of our government officials are bought and paid for by China. When did you start noticing the really big difference that, okay, maybe America's not what I thought it was after all?
I'll put it this way. I think I am less inclined to believe that people are bought off than they are basically engaging in a form of ideological capture. And what I mean by that is, I think if you were to ask the vast majority of people in Congress or even prominent what we might call progressive activists, and you say, "Oh, are you a communist?" They'd be like, "No, of course not." They just believe in kindness and sharing and getting along with one another. But then if you look within our education system, especially our higher education system, if you look within what has happened within sociology departments, what has happened within pretty much all of the social sciences or the liberal arts component of higher ed, what you find is that they've pretty much bought into this notion of critical theory. And we think of critical theory as critical race theory, but that's really only one component of it. When you actually look at critical theory and you look at the Frankfurt School, what you find is that there was a very concerted effort, and some of this was supported by governments like the Soviets during the Cold War and whatnot, where of course they were trying to influence American classrooms and politics, just like we were trying to influence their politics. But what you really saw within academia is somewhat of a commitment to the way that Marx explained the world, the idea that the world is separated into oppressor and oppressed. Mm-hmm. Now Marx really focused on the economic side of that. Mm-hmm. But if you start to look at the writings of people like Antonio Gramsci, if you start looking at Herbert Marcuse, if you start looking at Michel Foucault and people like that within critical theory, within postmodernism, one of the things they recognize is that communism couldn't really beat capitalism when it came to economics. Exactly. Because free market economics and capitalism actually delivered the goods. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that Gramsci really focused on, and what became known as, he didn't coin this term, but it became known as the march through the institutions. It was the idea that if you really wanted for socialism, for Marxism to become successful, then you actually needed to set up a kind of counterculture. Because it wasn't just that capitalism produced good economic results, it's that the various institutions that are allowed to thrive within a free market economy all reinforce this idea that individual liberty, property rights, personal responsibility, that these are all key and essential. And mm-hmm. then you add into that, you know, Judeo-Christian values of the nuclear family, of the idea of objective truth, objective morality, mm-hmm. and you have a very stable culture, which provides for a lot of benefits that are not just economic. And so Gramsci's idea was, is okay, we have to compete with that. And so you can't compete with that based off of an economic model. It has to be more comprehensive. And so that's what you start to see, right? You start to see this through the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, where you had that sort of ideological capture going on within higher ed, within the arts and entertainment and Hollywood. And let's face it, if the people educating your children or the people going to higher education in order to get the credentials to teach your elementary and your high school age children, mm-hmm. if the movies that you watch, if the songs that you listen to are all inundated with this kind of explanation of the world where you're either an oppressor and oppressed, and the way that we, you know, beat the oppressors and liberate the oppressed is through this, you know, through strong governments that come in and liberate people, and we're going to have redistribution, and we're going to make things more egalitarian and equal within society, and we're going to achieve equity through more government intervention. Should we really be surprised when one day that becomes the popular ideology within a country? Mm-hmm. China didn't have to pay anybody off in order to achieve that. In many cases, we did it to ourselves, because I think we became very complacent with the idea that, well, things are pretty good, and we have a culture within the United States that generally recognizes and believes in certain things. And before you know it, our kids are being educated in institutions, and they're watching movies, and they're listening to songs, and they're reading books. And you're not competing. The 8 hours a day that Hollywood and the school system and the college professors have with your kids, you're not competing with that with maybe 30 minutes around the dinner table.
Right.
And so I honestly believe that if we're going to really solve this issue, we need to properly diagnose it. And we need to recognize that so much of this happened not because of any, you know, grandiose, nefarious plan from one government or one institution. It happened because they did a better job selling their ideology to our children at a very young age, whereas we thought we were just sending them to school, or we were just mm-hmm. doing right by them by making sure they got a good college education. Mm-hmm. And it really takes more from parents. We have to actually sit down and not just tell our kids what they should believe, but actually explain why it's so critical and why ideas have consequences. Mm-hmm. And believing the wrong ideas simply because you think that the people that are espousing them have good intentions is not sufficient. There's a reason why we say the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Mm-hmm. Most of the horrible atrocities that have happened throughout human history have not happened because of a couple people that were mean and evil and greedy. It happened because people had very evil ideas that they thought were morally justifiable. Mm-hmm. And teaching your kids to properly understand that, identify it, and be resilient against it, that's what's critical. So I think when I look around and I see what's going on with our country, I just think I see decades of higher education then spilling into our elementary schools, our middle schools, our high schools, our arts and entertainment. And if everywhere you look, this just seems to be the normal way to think about things. I don't think we should be shocked when our kids start to adopt it as their belief system.
I mean, you made some phenomenal points just right now, and you're right. This is how they've created this ideology in our nation to try and change our culture, but someone somewhere had these nefarious plans. And we know Joe Biden has been receiving money from foreign countries all over. It's been coming out in the legislative hearings in Congress. And I remember Mike Pompeo coming out and speaking to the governors, knowing that the Chinese people, we were paying off the governor. Some governors took it, some didn't. He addressed the governors. I saw the video of that where he said, we know that you guys have been talking to China, and we know some of you guys have been getting money from China. He didn't specify what states or not, but so
there's no question, when you look at institutions of higher education, the amount of money that they've taken from foreign governments has definitely influenced the way that they've crafted their curriculum. It's crafted the way they talk about certain mm-hmm. subjects. There's absolutely no question. There's no question that foreign governments have definitely been engaged in actively trying to influence our institutions of higher education, our media, and whatnot. That, yeah, there's, I'm not disputing that at all.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that. But you're right. And you know what? I don't know what it was about myself. I can only speak to what I went through growing up in school, but just what you said about the oppressed and the oppressors, I had teachers that taught that America was the oppressor. And I didn't believe that to be true. And I got kind of angry with some of my teachers who would teach that America are oppressors. My dad came from another country to come to this country. Why? Because it had opportunities. He wasn't rich. He came from a poor family. And yet he came the legal way to my nation. So I'm going to get to that thought in just a second, but right now I'm going to take a quick break.
Hi, this is Vem Miller from the Blood Money Podcast. I'm here to say don't ever miss an episode of the wonderful Amber May Podcast.
The First Amendment is under attack, but did you know you can help protect your constitutional rights by using your cell phone? Patriot Mobile is the only Christian conservative wireless provider that will always support freedom of speech and freedom of religion, and that's why I'm proud to partner with them. Patriot Mobile offers dependable nationwide coverage, giving you access to all three major networks, which means you can get the same coverage that you've been accustomed to without funding the left. When you switch to Patriot Mobile, you're supporting organizations like First Liberty, Alliance Defending Fund, Concerned Women for America, and more. Their 100% U.S.-based customer service team makes switching easy. Keep your number, keep your phone, or upgrade. Their team will help you find the best plan for your needs. Just go to patriotmobile.com/amber or call 972-PATRIOT. Get free activation when you use promo code AMBER at checkout. Join us. Make the switch today. patriotmobile.com/amber. That's patriotmobile.com/amber or 972-PATRIOT.
You are listening to The Amber May Show, and now we return to the show already in progress.
And it's always somewhat of a crack up to me when they talk about how capitalism oppresses the workers. I'm like, I know, that's why all those people in Miami are getting on leaky rafts and heading to Cuba. Oh, wait, no, it's going the opposite direction. Oh, I wonder why that is, you know, or it's the same thing where it's like, oh, the United States is some sort of, you know, racist hellscape for minorities and marginalized groups. Oh, that's why all the people coming into the country. You know, have they just not got that memo yet? Have they not heard yet from the Democratic Party what a horrible racist place this is? It's because on its face, it's nonsense, right? We can look around, look at reality and know this is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. This is not an accurate reflection of reality. So why do they keep saying it? Because it's useful for them politically. That's why. They are a party which is almost entirely built around this idea of grievance politics. They don't want you to feel strong, independent, empowered, and the ability to rise up and do things on your own. No, you have to be able to do it through them, right? They have to be the ones pulling the strings, whether it be in Washington, D.C. or Sacramento or Richmond or wherever it is, right? They have to be the ones pulling the strings because there's no way you could manage this without their benevolence, without their help. That's why it's so important that you drop everything you're doing to make sure they get in power, because my gosh, if they're not in power, what would happen to you? And you know, again, it's a narrative that unfortunately works. And, you know, you asked me before, like, was there a moment where I started to realize that things were tipping in a direction? I think early on when I went into the military right out of high school, right? I was enlisted. So I did a little bit of college here and there, but I remember the first time I was actually sitting in a classroom in Northern Virginia Community College, and it was an English class. And it seemed like 80% of our English class was dedicated to pushing this narrative of how horribly oppressive Western culture was. Mm. And I remember sitting with students, and keep in mind, I worked in counterinsurgency and unconventional warfare, right? A big part of my job was working in 12-man teams where we worked by, through, and with the local population. I sometimes joke that, you know, learning counterinsurgency prepared me more for domestic politics in college than anything else.
It probably did.
Yeah. But we're sitting there, and this English teacher is going through, you know, how horrible, you know, Cortez's conquest of the Aztecs were. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sitting here defending, you know, the Spanish conquistadors. I'm not saying they were all great guys. I mean, Pizarro did some horrible things. Cortez did some horrible things. There's no question, but he was couching this all in this idea of like, oh my gosh, how horrible was it that Cortez came over and here were all these peaceful Aztecs just growing maize. And then the next thing you know, these guys show up and, mm-hmm. you know, 100 of them kill it. I'm like, whoa. I said, you do realize that the Aztecs used to hold flower wars, which were these mm-hmm. ceremonial engagements where they would capture people from weaker tribes in order to sacrifice them to their gods, right? You realize that the real reason why Cortez was able to overthrow the Aztecs was because there were tens of thousands of tribesmen from other tribes that the Aztecs were oppressing that sided with Cortez to throw off the Aztec yoke. Like, you mm-hmm. get that's what was going on? And it, like, the answer is no concept of it. Why? Because he's not a history teacher, right? He's an English teacher. But the point was, is that he was going to use his classroom as a way to talk to students who were also not coming in equipped to talk about history.
Correct.
In yep. order to push a particular agenda. And it's one of the things that is so prominent within, again, liberal arts classes, is that you will have a teacher pushing a particular narrative on a topic for which none of the students are prepared to actually engage in. I had another English teacher, this same university, another English teacher, and he gave us all the Communist Manifesto to read. And I always said, yeah, and it was English literature, right? Because nothing screams English literature like a communist German. But anyway, he gives us the Communist Manifesto to read. And, we come into class the following week, and here's the question he asks. So what do you all think of capitalism? And this student raises his hand and goes, well, I think capitalism is what's destroying this country. And I remember looking over and I said, okay, I didn't want to, again, at this point, I'm like 31, 32. I got a wife, 3 kids and a mortgage, mm-hmm. right? I'm not here for the college experience. I'm just trying to right. knock out my classes. But I remember looking over at him and I'm saying, can you please tell me what capitalism is? And he goes, well, capitalism is this oppressive power structure where the people at the top hoard resources. I said, whoa, slow down a second. I'm not asking for Karl Marx's caricature of capitalism. I'm asking, do you know the definition? And the professor looks at me and he goes, well, do you? I said, yeah, it's a system of economics where, you know, you can have private ownership of the means of production and exchange takes place in an involuntary environment. And he goes, okay, we can use that. I'm like, what do you mean we can use that? Like, that's what capitalism is.
Yes.
And it's the private ownership of the means of production and distribution through a system of voluntary exchange. That's what capitalism is. Mm-hmm. Can you have bad, mean capitalists? Sure. But that's what the system is, right? It's peaceful transaction of mm-hmm. property and goods and services. That's what it is. And I look back over at the other student. I'm like, so what's your problem with capitalism? And he goes, well, I'm not saying I'm a communist. I just think the truth is somewhere in between. I'm like, oh, okay. The truth is in between. So on one hand, I have stuff, you have stuff. And the only way that we can engage and exchange is if both of us agree to it. And we both believe that we're going to get mutual benefit. On the other side, within communism, right, the practical outworking of that is the abolition of the private ownership of the means mm-hmm. of production. Right. So who owns it? Well, presumably the state, right? Or the body politic, right? The mm-hmm. state. So on one side, I got stuff, you got stuff. We only exchange if it's to mutual benefit. On the other stuff, you don't got any stuff, mm-hmm. right? You don't get to own a factory. You don't get to own a business. You don't get to own any of that, right? And the government ends up telling you what it is that you can have, where you'll work, what you'll do, how you'll be educated, where to live. What part of this do you want to trade for this?
Mm-hmm.
And what was fascinating about that entire exchange, and I will give both those college professors credit in the sense that they allowed the debate to take place.
Mm-hmm.
But what I ended up seeing was is that, you know, in that classroom where we probably had about 30 students with age ranges from 18 to 45, about 5 different countries represented, what I noticed in that moment was when they actually heard what capitalism was, when they actually heard somebody just defend it at a very basic level,
mm-hmm.
they were they thought it was a good idea. They thought it was a good system. Mm-hmm. But if no one's standing up to say anything in that environment, all they get is, well, it's a mean, rigid, class-based structure where the people at the top hoard the resources. And if that's the only explanation you got, well, of course you're not going to like it.
Mm-hmm.
And if the only explanation you have for socialism or communism, which, by the way, those terms can be used practically interchangeably.
Yes, they can.
If the only explanation you got for that is, well, this is the one where we all work together. You know, this is the system where from each according to their ability and to each according to their needs. And there's no need to actually review the history books on how that's played out in real life. Well, then, of course, you're going to think that's the superior system.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it is just, again, you get to a point where when you have this much, when you have a country that has produced this much prosperity, this much security, this much general affluence, mm-hmm. this much upward economic mobility, regardless of race or sex or economic circumstances at birth, right? You get used to, well, this is just the way it works. This just must be the way it is. And all of a sudden it allows for other ideas to creep in on, well, you know, we could make it even better. Because yeah, if you're comparing America to some sort of, you know, ideal, which has never existed within human history, well, mm-hmm. then obviously we've got a lot to make up for. But if you're comparing America and our system with everything else throughout human history, oh my gosh, we've accomplished quite a bit. We got a lot to be proud of. We got a lot we shouldn't be proud of, but we've got a lot to be proud of comparatively mm-hmm. speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And even if we have a long way to go, I would say that we have a long way to go into fully realizing the promise of America that you find in the Declaration of Independence, not completely trashing it and replacing it with a bunch of ideas that have led to nothing but starvation, oppression, murder, gulags, famines. Like, my gosh, this should be an easy argument, but we got to make it.
Yeah. And recently on your episode, you've been talking about the spheres of influence, and you were talking about Hollywood. And I was so grateful for your talk on Hollywood, because it's stuff that I've been talking about with Hollywood, how they've been programming the way we think, the watching the buffoon dad and the overbearing mom, and, you know, just the way they would interact on TV and trying to change our worldview on TV, accepting this lifestyle over that lifestyle. And if you didn't accept this lifestyle, you were this horrible person, and just shoving things down our throat. And you were talking about the movie industry and how people aren't buying into that. And you still wonder, how are they making money? Like, I still wonder, like, how are they still in, like, able to make movies when no one's going to their movies? Because that's not what people want to see. And I'm glad people are stopping and going to watch these films, or thinking differently about how they're watching TV now, because it's not just entertainment, it's messaging. It's a delivering a vision. That's why I guess they call it television. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, so I love that you've been talking about that on your show recently. You want to talk about that briefly, about some sure. of the spheres of influence?
We had a great guest on, Gary Bakler from Nerdrotic. And he's got a really interesting life and backstory. Used to own a comic book shop in San Francisco. So like right off the bat, you're not thinking, oh, this is a guy that's going to be challenging the woke narrative in Hollywood. But he does it probably better than just about anybody on YouTube right now. And it's shown. He's got over 1 million subscribers. I love watching his channel. And one of the big things that he does is that he simply talks about what Hollywood is doing and so many of the problems with it. And it's not overtly political. A lot of what he discusses is just why they've done just such a bad job in storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And this is another thing that I think is really important for mm-hmm. conservatives to understand. We don't need to ride what I call riding the elephant into every conversation, right? A lot of times the number one thing that stands out about what Hollywood is doing right now is not that it's woke, it's that it sucks. Right?
Like it does.
It's not good. Oh my. It's not good storytelling. It's not good character development.
Totally.
And Nerdrotic, what Gary does such a good job of explaining why it's so bad and why they've done such a bad job. And then on top of that, he's also explaining how, okay, if it's bad and we all know it's bad, why do they keep doing it? And that's where he gets into talking yes. about the agenda behind it, mm-hmm. right? That this is being pushed. The
Thank you for joining us today on The Amber May Show. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please make sure you like, share, and subscribe. And if there's someone that came to mind, please share this episode with them. Please follow us on Telegram at The Amber May Show, True Social Amber May, Frank Socially Amber May, or Clout Hub. I can't wait to see you next time on The Amber May Show. EBSRA LLC is a registered investment advisor. The information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investment, or investment strategies. Investment involves risk, and unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed. Be sure to first consult with a qualified financial advisor and/or tax professional before implementing any strategies discussed.